Welcome to our Reach Next Generation podcast. I'm Grace Jeffries, and I'm thinking about my future. To help me with this, I'm speaking with successful women to get an understanding of the challenges they have faced throughout their careers, how they became them, and what tips they have for girls of my age. Today my guest is Baroness Susan Greenfield, who is a scientist, writer, and broadcaster. Susan is currently working on helping people with Alzheimer's disease with new research. Susan co-founded the biotech company NeuroBio Ltd, where she is Chief Executive Officer. Thanks for joining me today, Susan. Can we start by you telling us all how your career took you to a career in science?
Well, it's a great pleasure to meet you, Grace, and it's very exciting to do this. I wish when I was at your age someone has had podcasts and done this kind of interview. So when I was at your age, I didn't really want to do science. I hated it. And I'm hoping for your sake that perhaps it's taught better now at schools than it was in my day. Because in my day, you just did the amoeba. I don't know if you do the amoeba anymore. It's a single cell animal.
Oh, yeah.
And then you draw a sort of egg timer and then two circles. And that's the amoeba reproducing itself. It just splits in two. Or we did things like distilling water in chemistry.
Yeah.
No one told me why you'd want to do that or why distilling water was interesting. Yeah. And all you did was sort of stencil conical flasks and so on. And there was no real scope for doing well other than just being neat, which I never was. Yeah. So science for me didn't hold much interest because it didn't really ask any exciting or big questions. There wasn't any scope for being creative or imaginative or having your own ideas. And I was attracted much more to history and literature. And
yes.
In fact, what I really did, and you may find this, and I think this makes a big difference when you're at your stage at school, is the particular teachers, how exciting they are and how inspirational. And just by chance, at my school, we had a very inspirational, exciting classics teacher. She taught Latin and Greek. Mm-hmm. So just because her lessons were so exciting and she made them so lively, I decided to do Latin and Greek. For A-level, yeah? So I did Latin and Greek and ancient history and maths, actually, because I quite enjoyed maths. So I didn't do science at all. I hated it. Whereas in studying Roman history and Greek history, to my mind, you were exploring really interesting issues like what makes one person different from another? Why do wars start? Kind of question we're asking even now. Themes such as how much is it fate and how much is it your own abilities that make things happen or not, yeah? So this for me seemed a much more exciting way of spending my time than studying the amoeba or distilling water. So I really wanted at university to do philosophy because to my mind, this philosophy would have been a natural extension of asking those kind of questions. And I went up to Oxford originally, therefore, with classics, with Latin and Greek, very excited to do philosophy. But the way it was taught there was formal logic. And having done maths, that really wasn't too much of a challenge. And also, it was all about language. I remember sitting in the library, and there was a whole chapter, unbelievably, on the definite article, on the. Can you imagine reading a whole chapter? Someone had written a whole chapter on the.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, exactly. And meanwhile, there was a new subject just starting in those days. We're talking 1,000 years before you were born, obviously. called psychology, and this was a new subject, and they were just starting it. So I was allowed to switch to that, and that for me was really interesting, but I got even more interested, not so much in behavior. So there was animal behavior, there was child behavior, but what I was more interested in was what they called emotion motivation, that's feelings and how the brain was working and hormones. And so in a way, I got into science through the back door, you know, by doing it without any formal qualifications. And so I'd also say as advice to you girls, you know, that just because you don't tick the box and you're not the expected profile doesn't mean to say you couldn't have a go, couldn't try and do it, because I didn't have the profile at all of having done science. And I had very supportive people at university who actually let me try, even though I wasn't formally qualified to do it. And
yeah.
I remember going to see the head of the pharmacology department, Professor Peyton, my tutor, said I should be a scientist and go and see him. And he said, do you know what a millimolar solution is? Now, that's the equivalent in arts speak of saying, have you heard of Shakespeare? You know? And I said, frankly, no, I don't know what it is. And he said, well, you can tell us about Homer in the coffee breaks. I always remember that. So it was that spirit of have a go, you know, have a go, and you'll find out if, you know, you're able to rise to it or not. And of course, I had to work harder, but that tells you how much you want to do it. You know, you have to put more effort in. But in life, the only things worth doing are things that are worth putting effort in. So, you know, for me, it was very rewarding. And then by doing that, I realized I could ask the kind of questions I'd asked at your age, but I could actually turn to the physical world, the physical brain. So issues like what makes you different from me? How are the brains of humans different from the brains of other animals? Are animals conscious? What is a mind? Yeah, all those things. I suddenly saw you could actually, rather than just go round in circles, as you do kind of in philosophy, you could actually make some progress. So that's why I did science. And then it was now.
Well, you mentioned that you went to Oxford University. Yeah. But how important do you think it actually is to go to university?
That's a really good question. And I think it depends so much on the kind of person you are. So my brother never went to university, for example, and yet he's very bright. He always took computers apart. I think he's a good case in point in that he hated reading books. He was dyslexic. I don't think he's ever read a novel in his life. But when he was about your age, he actually started pulling apart old computers that people had discarded and putting them back together again. And he taught himself how computers work that way. So some people aren't academic and they don't learn well from books or from theory, but they learn by empirically with their hands and by exploring things. And I think that in life, you have to find what you enjoy doing and what you're good at doing. And usually those two things go absolutely together. And I think my own view is it's a mistake to assume that everyone's got to go to university. If you don't go to university, you know, then you're in the you know, second division or something like this. I think that is utterly wrong. I think the world needs people that do their job well and enjoy doing it. And if you're a plumber, for example, and you enjoy what you do and you get a pride in doing a really good job, you're in a much better position than someone who's paying off a huge student debt, who wasn't really happy, who was like my brother, who would have been a square peg in a round hole. I think that really you have to just not listen to how other people judge you, but you've got to just find out what you're good at and what you enjoy. And yeah, irrespective of status or money, as long as it's legal, of course. Yeah, what you did. As long as it doesn't hurt anyone else. Yeah. Then go for it and do that. You know, I think that I feel very sad because in my day, very few people went to university because there were no student loans. There was a grant scheme. And in fact, I was in a way fortunate because my parents had no money. So I was on a full grant. You know, but that I realized was a huge privilege. And yeah, I think, you know, that loan schemes are good for people that will benefit from university and really turn it around. But if you prefer doing something else, you're better at something else, then don't be a square peg in a round hole.
Yeah. So obviously we've all been hit by COVID, with things just beginning to feel normal again. But how have you had to deal with the COVID-19 issues, both personally and professionally?
I think there's actually, I think for like everyone, it's made you turn in yourself much more. We've all had to just think about what we're doing with our lives, the quality of life, how we're going to communicate with people we love and people we're close to and our friends. And I think perhaps it's made people just question things and question values in a way that perhaps we all took for granted and didn't before. And I certainly did. There have been some good things actually about COVID. For example, because I normally play squash not very well, but of course that was closed. So I took up running, which I've never done before, because it's the only exercise that was possible. And actually, I feel now a lot fitter. I've been doing it for 2 years, and I'm quite proud. You know, my fitness level's gone right up. So that was a good thing. Also, I realised how much time I was wasting in downtime when I was travelling a lot. So I was travelling a lot for my work, and you won't be at this stage yet, but you may be aware that when you travel, there's a kind of low-grade anxiety. You know, you're waiting for trains or planes that are late and you're not quite sure when they are, and you're hanging around, and then you've got to get things at the other end, and you know, you're still waiting. So there's a lot of hanging around, and however grand your style of travel, even if the hotels are posh and you're in smart parts of the plane and so on, there's still the downtime, there's still the jet lag, there's still the low-grade, it's low-grade anxiety and stress. And during COVID, of course, I had none of that, and it was great. I suddenly realised what had all this extra time that wasn't being spent sitting in cars, sitting in trains and planes, sitting in hotel rooms, watching CNN or BBC World, because I didn't speak the language of the country I was in. So I was just watching over and over again, the news looping around. So that has been a huge benefit as well. I think the downside was not seeing my friends as much as I could or wanted to, not actually mixing with people. And when the first lifted, I remember going to our local shopping centre in the Westgate and just walking around the shops, just because it was so nice being part of a crowd, you know, just milling around, being part of an anonymous crowd of humanity. It was such a... So I think on balance, yes, of course, there's been terrible consequences, certainly for people's businesses, certainly for a lot of people your age, I think, in terms of normal interaction and mixing. But there have been one or two downsides. I think that it has perhaps, I don't know if you yourself, Grace, if you feel it made you think more about what you wanted out of life and to slow down a little bit, and, you know. So on the whole, of course, it's we'd like to have not had the COVID crisis. But as always in life, I think it's important to see the benefits of bad things, you know, and to look at how one can turn around things that seem unfortunate but might have an upside, might have a silver lining.
Well, you definitely sound like quite the optimist sometimes.
I think if you're a scientist, you have to be an optimist, because you're doing things that no one else has done before. Most people tell you aren't going to work, so and usually they go wrong. So if you're a sort of glass half empty person, then science wouldn't be the career for you. But I think, heavens, you know, just look at it, it's a lovely spring day as we're speaking. You know, the world is lovely. We're so privileged. To especially we who have enough to eat and who are not in danger and not in pain, you know. I think how can one not be optimistic?
Yeah. So I know that you are a part of the Global Women Club, and I was just wondering what you do on a daily basis to support them and how you are a part of that company.
Okay, so I was really excited when I first came across them, because I was expecting, quite often when women of different, older than you perhaps, get together, they tend to complain a lot, and it's very easy to moan to each other. And, you know, in a way, it's quite nice moaning to someone, and they moan back, and you know, but it's a bit negative. And I was expecting, when I first met them, it to be something like that. But actually, I was amazed. The atmosphere was electric, and I'd never been among such fizzy, bright, fun, exciting group of women, you know, from all different backgrounds and so on, in different sectors. And the phrase that kept ringing in my ear was, it doesn't have to be the old way. It doesn't have to be the old way that I grew up, where you were very aware that sometimes men patronized you, or that it was, you had to struggle to assert yourself, and that you had to sort of turn yourself into an honorary man in some way, or be like them. And I realized you didn't have to be like that. And that nowadays, I think the generation that you're in will actually, I hope, be a new type of woman that can be yourselves and at the same time be respected and be assertive and be successful, rather than feeling that you're overcoming huge hurdles all the time.
Of course. So throughout your career, have you had any mentors, or have there been anyone that you particularly admired?
Yes, always. I think someone once said, a mentor is someone who believes in you more than you believe in yourself. So I've got several mentors. One is my Greek teacher. She was called Veronica Lemon. She's still alive. She was astonishing. She was very lively, and I say she just made everything so exciting. Then there was my tutor at Oxford, Jane Mellenby. Sadly, she's died now. She only died about a year ago, but she was the one who thought it would be a laugh if I was a scientist, and who approached life not just with optimism, but with a sense of huge fun, you know, of huge excitement and can-do and mentality. Another mentor is John Stein, who you won't have heard of, but you'll have heard of his brother, Rick Stein, who's the famous chef. So John is his older brother, who's not famous like Rick is. He's not a TV chef, but he was a medical tutor at Oxford, and I'd still see him a lot. And he's someone, even though he's a man, that I regard as a mentor. So a mentor doesn't have to be another woman. It can be. And then women I admire, there's two in particular that I would love to have met, and of course haven't. One was Elizabeth I. I think she was amazing. Yes. She's like, if I could ever have a dinner party with dead people, you know, she would be top of the list, Elizabeth I. And then the other one you won't have heard of possibly is a lady called Rita Levi Montalcini. As you can guess from the name, she's Italian, yeah? Yes. Well, she was. And she was born in the early 1900s, and she was Jewish, and she lived in Italy. And that was the time when fascism was rising at that part of the world. And because she was Jewish, she was forbidden. She was a medical doctor. Because she was Jewish, she was forbidden from practicing medicine. Now, most people would have really been traumatized by that and given up. But what she did was she started a lab in her own house and started doing biomedical research because she couldn't practice medicine. And the research that she did then eventually won the Nobel Prize.
Yeah.
Can you imagine that? And on top of that, she lived to be about 103. She was very beautiful. If you look her up on the internet, you'll see she's really elegant and beautiful. She was in the Italian equivalent of the House of Lords, the Senate. So she is my real hero.
Yeah. So can you tell me a little bit more about what your company NeuroBio does?
Sure. So what we're doing is developing a very different approach from everyone else to trying to treat Alzheimer's. As you may know, Alzheimer's is a terrible condition that happens in older age. It's not a natural consequence of aging, but it is a disease of older people. And it's characterized very sadly by not just a loss of memory and confusion, but towards the end, the person doesn't recognize people that they used to love and know. They retreat. They're like 2-year-olds or 1-year-olds again. So unlike heart disease or cancer, which are, of course, life-threatening and very serious conditions, Alzheimer's is a very spiteful condition. It's very cruel because it robs you of being able to look through photos with your grandchildren, for example. Yeah. So what we're trying to, and there's no treatment that works. So we're trying to change all that. And I think partly because I didn't do science originally and I didn't have the dogma and the background that perhaps most people have. I've asked questions a bit like the Emperor's New Clothes type questions, you know, and because of that, we've developed a very different approach. And we're slowly putting the jigsaw pieces together. And we're very excited because on April the 5th, we're doing a press conference to celebrate the publication, a peer review paper that we think really proves that we are on the right track. It doesn't have all the answers, but it shows we're on the right track. And what it will show is the drug that we've designed, a very novel drug, in a mouse model of Alzheimer's, actually improves the memory and lowers the brain chemicals to normal. So it's an exciting time, and that's what we're doing. And so sometimes I feel very privileged because when I look at my friends who are playing golf or playing bridge or just sort of, you know, who are semi-retired and just hanging around, I've got a reason to get up in the morning. And I think that in life, if you have a reason to get up in the morning, you should be really pleased.
Well, the world is changing so much and so quickly. But what do you think work for women might look like in 10 years' time? Or what do you hope work for women might look like in 10 years' time?
I think the most important thing I would like is for a woman to not have to struggle between choosing whether to have a family or not. And for many women, there is this, certainly in science and basic research, there is the great problem of whether you have a kid or not. I don't have children, partly because my brother put me off babies when he was small. So that wasn't really a problem. But for a lot of women in basic science, they either have to put off having children and then they're beyond their biological optimum because the stages you go through have no permanency to them. They're just very fixed contracts and so on. Or you don't have children at all, or you have kids and then come back and you're disadvantaged because your male competitors have got 2 or 3 years ahead of you. Yeah. Or inevitably you're torn because you don't know whether to be with the children or to be in the lab. And that I would like to, and I think a way around that, or that's expensive, is to have lots more creches attached to laboratories, you know, where you can pop and see your kid. And it's not, it was like that when I worked in France. There was much more, that was much more the norm. So I know it's possible. Yeah. So I'd like to see in the future schemes that really supported women coming back from childcare or to be able to have a research career or science career at the same time as they had children, because it does put a lot of talented women off doing science because of that, you know. And I think that just because we're the ones that get pregnant, it seems unfair that there should be such a disadvantage.
Of course. Well, I've really enjoyed chatting with you today, Susan. Thank you so, so much. And I'm sure everyone listening will now be thinking about some of the choices they're about to make in their own careers. Keep listening to the Reach Next Generation podcasts as I talk to many more brilliant women. For more information about us, visit reachnextgeneration.com. And thank you to our sponsors, Barclays Bank, Levi Strauss, Sage PLC, Haynes Watts, and Ideal Standard.